Thank you very much. To this point in this series of lectures, you've heard an awful lot of theory, and you've seen an awful lot of complex structures. And I think the organizers must think that your minds are saturated with mathematics and also with topological features. And so they've asked me to talk about a molecule which, in essence, is unidimensional, at least functionally, and where you need nothing more than simple arithmetic to understand what I have to say. I wanted to start showing a picture of a very famous Swedish chemist, Jens Jakob Berzelius, who is behind Carrie Mullis and myself. This picture hangs in the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in Stockholm. The other day, the great German mathematician Gauss was quoted, and I thought in the interest of the national duality of this meeting, I should quote a Swedish scientist of the same era. In 1908, Berzelius, in an address to the King of Sweden, said, "Of all the sciences, the one that is going to contribute most to medicine will be chemistry." Now, this showed that Berzelius had a perception that is a feature of modern sciences, that is, they make sure they tell their sponsor, their patron, that their science is going to be most important to the patron's particular interest. And of course, all patrons' interest is most particular in their own health. And so he was exercising grantsmanship, no doubt, at that time. The thing that made possible chemistry to contribute to genetics, of course, was not possible at the time of Berzelius's statement. In fact, it wasn't possible till just after the middle of the last century, when three different scientists did three quite different things. Charles Darwin explained the origin of species and evolution. Gregor Mendel deciphered the rules of inheritance amongst organisms that have two sets of each gene, that is, in diploid organisms. And Friedrich Miescher, working in Hoppe Seiler's laboratory at Tübingen, really the first of all biochemistry laboratories, discovered by extracting the pus cells of used hospital bandages, which is recycling, long before we thought of recycling as a technology that should be practiced, he discovered DNA, nuclein. And I thought you'd like to see these three individuals. There is a young Charles Darwin. There is Gregor Mendel, and there is Friedrich Miescher. Their three contributions at that time resulted in different things happening. Friedrich Miescher essentially founded a school of nucleic acid chemistry, which ultimately was completed 80 years later, approximately, when Alexander Todd and his group deciphered the nature of the phosphodiester linkage between nucleosides in DNA. Mendel's work, of course, was ignored for almost 50 years until the beginning of the 20th century. Darwin, on the other hand, caused some stir right away because he was telling people something that they didn't like to know. He was telling them that they were related to other species. And of course, that had the consequence of getting some reaction from the people who heard that they were related to other species. The thing that I want to do next is, again, in the interest of reciprocity, to quote the great German chemist, Emil Fischer, in the early part of this century. And he said something much more specific than did Berzelius, because what Emil Fischer said was that organic chemistry was going to contribute to genetics. And of course, that was an exceeding daring statement for him to make, because first of all, there was really no knowledge about the nature of genetics in a molecular sense. The first real insight to that came in 1941 when Beadle and Tatum pointed out that each gene was probably encoding a protein, and there was this one relationship between genes and proteins. It was not still known at that time what was the nature chemically of the gene. And of course, that became known in 1944 when Avery and MacLeod and McCarty, through the classical natural product chemistry technology of purifying and then testing for biological activity, showed that the material of inheritance was in fact DNA. Analysis of DNA from many species by Erwin Chargaff showed that there was an unusual property in DNA where the base composition could vary enormously from species to species, but however, there was always the same amount of adenine as there was thymine in DNA, and there was always the same amount of cytosine as there was guanine. And of course, this pairing of the bases led Watson and Craik, together with the fiber diffraction data of Rosalind Franklin, to deduce that DNA had the structure of a double helix. Another thing that is pertinent to my discussion today was the deciphering of the genetic code by Karana and Nierenberg. And of course, Karana and Nierenberg and the late I'm forgetting people's names already, got the Nobel Prize for that work. Now, there were a whole series of other discoveries made in this period of time, and these discoveries were made by enzymologists and biochemists who were curious about the nature of the biochemistry of nucleic acids. And they discovered, for instance, that there were small chromosomes in bacteria which could be isolated and manipulated. They discovered enzymes which would cleave DNA at particular sequences, the restriction enzymes. They discovered enzymes which would join DNA fragments together, the DNA ligases, the enzymes which are involved in polymerizing DNA, and methods for genetic transformation, that is, for taking DNA in a test tube and putting it into a living cell and having that DNA function in the living cell and also be passed on in functional form to succeeding generations of cells. And then methods for chemical synthesis and DNA sequencing were developed. And together, these discoveries generated a new technology. And of course, that technology was the technology of forming recombinant DNA, that is, combining DNA from different organisms, and also the technology of genetic engineering. Now, the possibility of a chemist contributing to this study lies in the fact that the pairing of bases is because of specific hydrogen bonding of adenine to thymine and guanine to cytosine, and this pairing holds the two chains of the double helix together. And so it was possible for a chemist to think in terms of chemically synthesizing fragments of DNA and using those particular sequences to interact with complementary strands. The possibility of this happening, that is, having a chemistry that would make this possible, started really in the early 1950s. Again, it started with someone I've already mentioned, Alexander Todd. An administrator from the University of British Columbia, Gordon Shrum, went to England to recruit scientists. And as you can see here, he was a physicist, and he thought physicists were too expensive. And so he tried to recruit chemists. And he went to see Todd in Cambridge and asked him, "Do you have any young scientists I could recruit to come to Canada, to Vancouver?" And Todd said, "Yes, I've got this young man, and he's from India, and there are no jobs in India for him, and furthermore, there were no jobs in 1950 and 52 in England for Indians." And of course, that young man was Gobind Khurana, who's shown here with his wife Esther. And the reason Shrum was able to recruit Khurana to Vancouver was he said to him, "You can do what you please in science. There are no obligations to do anything, just do what you're interested in," which is an important principle, of course, in basic science to remind ourselves of in these days of pressures to be more applied in our work. Now, one of the things that Khurana did early on was to develop a synthesis of adenosine triphosphate. This paper was published in 1954, and it's hard for young people such as yourselves to put yourself back 40 years, but in the early 1950s, the only available nucleoside triphosphate was ATP, which was isolated from yeast. And it had just become apparent that nucleoside triphosphates, both of the ribo and the deoxyseries, were central and essential components of biosynthesis. And so there was a tremendous interest in this synthesis that Corona developed at that time. And it made this young scientist, he was in his early 30s at that time, suddenly a famous individual. One of the consequences was that it attracted quite eminent people to visit his lab. And this is a picture of a young Paul Berg on the left and a young Arthur Kornberg on the right visiting his laboratory in Vancouver in the early 1950s. Of course, his work also attracted scientists, and this shows two postdoctoral fellows that came to his lab in 1956, Peter Gillam on the left and myself with hair on top on the right. And we're showing Gobind Khurana where the phosphate is in AMP, in case he didn't know, in this molecule. Now, just 1 month before I arrived in Vancouver, in September 1956, and in August 1956, this slide should say 56, Khurana carried out a reaction. He was trying to make a toluene sulfonyl ester on the 3' position of thymidine 5' phosphate as a model study for a chemical method of degrading DNA sequentially to determine the DNA structure. And in fact, the reaction, instead of forming that ester, gave rise to a series of oligomeric thymidylic acids. In other words, in trying to develop a reaction to degrade DNA, Khurana discovered the first viable synthetic reaction for DNA synthesis. And Khurana was not a stupid man, and so he forgot about sequencing DNA, and he went on to exploit this chemical synthesis. And he did three cardinal things with this methodology. He first of all used short synthetic oligonucleotides to define the mechanism of action of enzymes working on DNA and RNA nucleases. He used his ability to synthesize oligodeoxynucleotides and oligoribonucleotides of defined sequence to elucidate the genetic code using the technology that had been developed by Marshall Nirenberg. And then he went on to develop the methods of gene synthesis. And again, there's a characteristic about Khurana which was very unusual for the time, because he not only used chemical tools to synthesize fragments of DNA, he also used enzymes to assemble those groups. And this was a somewhat heretical act for a synthetic chemist in those days. It was thought to be unethical to use a diesterase to break a diester bond, whilst it was quite appropriate to use sodium hydroxide, for instance. But of course, he had a tremendous perception, and if you think about it, the whole foundation of modern molecular genetics is the use of enzymes as synthetic tools. And that was a great perception on his part, that this was an important technology. Now, my involvement with the sort of work after leaving Khurana's lab started in 1968, and casting around for a new project for a graduate student, I asked the question, can a short synthetic oligonucleotide be used as a tool? What one had in mind at that time, this is 1968, and this predated genetic engineering, was to use affinity chromatography to isolate a particular messenger RNA from a mixture of many thousands of messenger RNAs. And there was some evidence that this might work for some work that that other postdoctoral fellow, Peter Gillam, had done. And so we started off to think about this, and we decided that if we were going to do this, we needed to know two things. First of all, the simple arithmetical one, that is, the question is, how long does an oligonucleotide have to be to recognize a particular target in an organism's genetic information? And that length relates to the size of the DNA in the organism. And so if there are 50,000 base pairs, such as in small viruses, then one needs an oligonucleotide of 9 nucleotides. On the other hand, the haploid human genome with its 3 billion base pairs requires an oligonucleotide of 17 nucleotides in length statistically to recognize uniquely a target. Now, the chemistry that Corona developed, which was the only available chemistry for about 20 years, was very difficult chemistry. It took many months to synthesize an oligonucleotide, and because of the low efficiency of that synthetic reaction, the longest oligonucleotide one could synthesize at that time was 10 or 12 nucleotides long. And therefore, it meant that if one was going to develop a technology to isolate particular messengers, one would have to target on messengers from bacteria or for yeast cells. One couldn't hope to go to more complex organisms if the methodology would work at all, even. Before we could attempt to do such a study, we needed some information which had to be obtained from model studies. And we started off from the sort of work that Peter Gillam had done, and we formed, with an oligonucleotide of defined sequence, a cellulose-linked matrix for affinity chromatography, using a simple diester-forming reaction. And the idea of this method was we would have one oligonucleotide attached to cellulose, and then the complementary oligonucleotide, which could be perfectly pairing according to Watson-Crick rules with the cellulose-attached oligonucleotide, or only partially pairing with it, would form a duplex at low temperature. And then if one passed buffer through this complex and gradually increased its temperature, at some temperature, this duplex would dissociate. And you could measure that temperature and therefore have some knowledge of the strength of the duplex. And I will show you in the next slide an example of how this works. For instance, if you have a column of oligonucleotide T9, it will separate different oligonucleotides of different lengths, A6, A7, A9 in length. And the separation is every bit as good as ion exchange chromatography for separation of oligonucleotides of that type. Carrying on that kind of experiment, we got a variety of data. And this shows some of the data, and it shows, for instance, the longer the oligonucleotide, the more stable the duplex in this complex between deoxy A's and deoxy T's, and this would eventually plateau out here. It's not a linear relationship. It plateaus out here at about 20 base pairs. We're also able to show if you made a duplex where there was a T opposite a T there, or a G opposite a T here in the deoxy series, then this was destabilized by about 15 degrees, or as if one had taken two base pairs off a duplex. In other words, one could distinguish quite readily between an 8 long and a 9 long, and one could distinguish between a perfectly matched duplex that's 9 long and one with a mismatch. Now, these are both deoxy oligonucleotides, and if one looks at the series where this is deoxy and this is ribo, again, you find there's increasing duplex stability with length, and also if you put a U in the middle of attractive A's, you see this same destabilization. But notice if you put a ribo G in attractive ribo A, there is very little destabilization. And so this was a dramatic difference between the behavior of a deoxy-deoxy pair and a deoxy-ribo pair, which was not anticipated. What could we conclude from these results? Well, there were four general conclusions. One was that we should be able to form a perfect duplex of a particular sequence and length, which should be distinguishable by its stability from other duplexes that are shorter or mismatched. In other words, in principle, we should be able to use the oligonucleotide to recognize a target. We also knew from that last experiment that really it would be better not to try and isolate messenger RNA, but to try and isolate DNA, because the duplex stability was going to be more specific. The other thing pertinent to looking at DNA, which mostly is double-stranded, was that the oligonucleotide would pair with its complement very rapidly at low temperature. Now, if you denature double-stranded DNA and try to reform the double helix from that, that will only take place at a high annealing temperature, which is determined by the base composition of the DNA. And so, although that would be thermodynamically a much more stable structure than one involving an oligonucleotide interacting with one strand of the DNA, you could take advantage of this kinetic phenomenon that at low temperature you could selectively or preferentially form form a duplex with a target using an oligonucleotide. And then the last thing, which is for later, because it relates to mutagenesis, was the fact that you could form a duplex at very low temperature with a short oligonucleotide, even though there was a mispairing of bases. Now, of course, what had happened, this work took about 4 or 5 years, starting in 1968 and culminating in the early 1970s. And in that period of 4 years, the last of the tools had been generated which allowed recombinant DNA technology to exist. And so there was the possibility of using the oligonucleotide to go after a piece of DNA because of the genesis of recombinant DNA technology. The question is, well, how would you know what piece of DNA to get? If you didn't know the DNA sequence, how could you design an oligonucleotide to isolate that DNA? And of course, the entry point was going to be protein sequences and the genetic code. The only problem is the genetic code is degenerate, and only for the amino acids methionine and tryptophan is there a unique codon, and for other amino acids there can be 2 or 3 or 4 or 6 different codons. And this has the following property. For instance, this is the N-terminus of cytochrome C from yeast, with the possible codons under that. And so, for instance, if you decided you wanted to use this particular set of amino acids as a basis for predicting DNA sequence, in fact, there were 768 different possibilities for a coding sequence for those amino acids because of the high degeneracy of the codons in this region. On the other hand, in this region, where the codons are less degenerate, you'd need a smaller number, 32 oligonucleotides. And of course, nowadays, mixed oligonucleotides of that sort of degeneracy are used. But we were trying to do this for the first time. And a basic principle in science is when you're trying to do something for the first time, you should make the system as simple as possible. And luckily, yeast geneticists, and principally Fred Sherman, had done something which made this possible. And what they'd done is study mutants in that cytochrome C from yeast, which were of the so-called double frameshift type, where in the coding sequence, at one point, a nucleotide was deleted from the DNA, and later on, a nucleotide was inserted. Now, if you do the amino acid sequence of this protein, you can partially guess the DNA sequence because of the partial degeneracy. And then if you do the amino acid sequence of this protein, you can also partially deduce the sequence within here. But of course, this C is moved one over from in here, and this C corresponds to this unknown nucleotide N here. And so you can deduce from this, this C, that this is a middle C here, corresponds to the N here. You can deduce what N is. And if you compare these two amino acid sequences and these codons, it means in this region, you can unambiguously predict the DNA sequence. And Sherman was able to do that for the first 13 amino acids, that is for 40 nucleotides. But of course, you recollect that the sequence which would be required to isolate a yeast piece of information was 13 long, and that was as long as we could synthesize. And so we made an oligonucleotide of 13 nucleotides to try and isolate the gene from cytochrome C. And this was work that we did in a collaboration with Dr. Benjamin Hall at the University of Washington. Now, the way we went about this was to clone yeast DNA, which was chopped into many fragments, in a bacterial virus vector from Lambda. This virus has the unusual property of not needing this middle section of DNA. This is essential, and this is essential. So if you cut this out of here and then join together this DNA, you get this long tandem repeated structure with a left arm of the virus, a piece of yeast DNA, and a right arm, and then another left arm, and then a different piece of yeast DNA, so forth. And then if you take the proteins which are involved in making the viral particle, which can be assembled in a test tube, these proteins will cut this into unit-length fragments, and then they will package each of these in a viral particle. And, of course, that means there's one piece of yeast DNA here, a different piece of yeast DNA here, and yet another piece here. And then if you make a very dilute suspension of those viral particles and infect a lawn of bacteria, each plaque, that is, each infective center will be generated by one viral particle and therefore will contain a unique piece of yeast DNA within that infective center. All the different progeny phage will have that one piece of DNA. And this allows one to separate all those different DNAs, which are essentially, in a chemical sense, very similar and not separable by physical chemical means. And what one needs to do, of course, is to be able to recognize which of those many different infective centers contains the DNA you're interested in. And this is possible using the oligonucleotide not as an affinity chromatographic agent, but as a radioactively labeled probe. And this is done by making a copy of this infected area on nitrocellulose and then denaturing the double-stranded DNA and then annealing at low temperature the radioactive oligonucleotide. And it will interact with DNA containing the gene. And then you can go back to this template and propagate more of this phage, and therefore you will have this DNA, which will have the gene in it that you desire to know. Now, the trouble is that cytochrome C is not made in these infected cells, E. coli, so you don't have any direct evidence that you have the gene. And so how could you find out that you have the gene? And of course, the entry point is to do the DNA sequence. I realized in 1955 that we were likely to be able to isolate this gene, and so I arranged to go to Fred Sanger's laboratory in Cambridge. And Fred Sanger was just starting out to sequence the DNA of this small bacteriophage, Phi X174, that affects E. coli. The reason he was studying this was because the viral particle, instead of packaging double-stranded DNA, packages single-stranded circular DNA, and this DNA can therefore be a template for the enzyme DNA polymerase, which was going to be the basis of Sanger's sequencing methodology. The DNA replicates as a double-stranded molecule in an infected cell, but at the end of the infective process, it starts to make single-stranded circles, which are packaged and which escape into mature viral particles. And the basis for the Sanger methodology is shown here. The idea is you use the viral DNA as a template and use a short complementary DNA fragment as a primer, and then you synthesize new DNA enzymatically using the four deoxynucleotides as substrates. However, if you incorporate in this mixture a fifth nucleotide, which lacks a 3' hydroxyl, then, for instance, this is dideoxy ATP with adenine here. When the template says put an adenine-containing nucleotide in here, at low frequency, and you can control this by the percentage of this nucleotide relative to the normal nucleotide, this will stop at this point. And you arrange things so only 1% of the times it stops there, and the other 99% of the times it carries on. And then it will stop again when the template says put another A in, and yet again when another A has to be put in. So here you have three fragments, which differ in length, and therefore can be separated electrophoretically. And this separation is shown here, the small fragments moving rapidly, and the larger ones more slowly. And of course, if you do this in four separate reactions, you get this pattern on the gel. Now, again, this is part of Sanger's unique genius. Not only did he realize that, unlike organic chemists who feel you have to get 100% yield in chemical reactions, his reaction required you only get 1% yield or less and get 400 different products. And then the other thing he realized, that you didn't actually have to identify the N nucleotide directly, you could identify it by the behavior of these fragments on the gel. And so without doing anything further other than separating the molecules, you could read off, following this pattern, the sequence of the DNA. And that was a remarkable thing, and it's why Sanger, of course, is one of that group of four people, along with Marie Curie and Linus Pauling and John Bardeen, to win two Nobel Prizes. And with this technology, or a predecessor of it, one was able to sequence the whole genome of Phi X174. And there was an amazing discovery. Something completely unpredicted from genetics and something completely unpredicted from biochemistry. And that discovery was that there were overlapping genes, that the same piece of DNA not only could encode for protein A, but it could also encode for protein B, or another segment of DNA could encode for protein D and also for protein E. And this is possible, of course, because of the triplet nature of the code. And so one protein will start reading at nucleotide 1 and read triplets from 1, 4, 7, 10, 13, and so on. And the other protein can start at nucleotide 2, reading triplets starting at 2, 5, 8, 11, 14, and so on. And so you get two different sequences for the same piece of DNA. And no one thought that was practically possible. Obviously, theoretically, it was possible. No one thought biology would allow it to be useful, and yet, in fact, it's so. And this is one of the reasons why genome sequence is so important, not only that it discovers overlapping genes, but it also discovers other things that are unknown, either from biochemistry or from genetics. Now, this brings me to the use of oligonucleotides as mutagens. And again, I want to refer to someone else, this time an American, Joshua Lederberg, who pointed out in 1958 that the ideal mutagenic method was needed, and that had to be one which would target a particular gene and make a particular change. Having made that statement, he speculated in his Nobel Prize-winning address on what it might be, and he didn't really come up with an answer. And the reason for this was, of course, that in 1958, genetic engineering did not exist. But of course, by the mid-1970s, when the sequence of PHYX174 was known, genetic engineering did exist, and one could think entirely of doing mutagenesis in a different way. What is this blinking? Ah, good. And again, we knew at that time that an oligonucleotide with a mismatch would form a stable duplex. And it was fairly easy then to think in terms of a strategy for making a mutant. That is to anneal such an oligonucleotide to a DNA and use DNA polymerase and DNA ligase to make this structure and to infect a bacterial cell with it. And you get progeny from the wild type template, which would be wild type, and you would get progeny from the fragment containing the oligonucleotide, which would be mutant. Now, the question was, would this work? And one of the nice things about this possible procedure was you could test in advance whether you could hit the right target. One test was to label an oligonucleotide with a mismatch with P32 and extend it with DNA polymerase and then cut with a restriction enzyme and run that on a gel. And if you only got one fragment, then you knew you'd only hit one target. You could also use this oligonucleotide as a primer for Sanger sequencing. And if this extended, then, of course, you would get the sequence immediately adjacent to the target, and so you'd be able to identify that you'd hit the correct target. Now, what could you use to experimentally test the idea? And again, there's the important thing to have a simple, analyzable system. The problem with small bacteriophage is that practically all their genes are essential. But there was one gene, and that is the gene E, which is responsible for lysis of the bacterial cell wall, which was not absolutely essential for infection. What would happen if you had a defect in that gene is you'd get an infected cell and the cell would be full of bacterial phage particles and they wouldn't break out. And you could figure out how to distinguish that from a normal infection. And so it was possible, using that as a target, to design an oligonucleotide, this one, which would mutagenize this tryptophan codon here and convert it to a TAG, which is a stop signal. And so you'd stop making this protein. At the same time, you'd change this valine codon, which is here is GTG, to GTA, which also still codes for valine. So you're changing this protein without changing this one with this methodology. And we were able to try this out, and at first it didn't work very well. And the reason it didn't work very well was that, in fact, a lot of the molecules were not complete circles. And so we were able to get rid of, in this special case, these molecules. And we're able to get rid of them because of a nuclease, S1, which will break down this structure, but will not break down this structure. So we could degrade these and then infect with this material, and then we would get mutants. And we were able to manipulate the conditions of the methodology to the point where we could get close to 50% of mutants. And that is the basis of the methodology we developed. I was going to describe its further amplifications, but I see my clock is getting towards the end of my 35 minutes, and I see the chairman putting his jacket on, and so I'm going to flip through several slides very quickly. Can we have the last slide? The last one. As the chairman said, in the paper we published on this work, we specified what we thought the methodology would be used for. We thought it would be used for studying properties intrinsic to DNA, such as signals for DNA replication, or signals for production of messenger RNA, or for the termination of messenger RNA, or for the production and termination of proteins. And that has been the case. But of course, the major use has been in protein structural studies, that is, in replacing amino acid codons to replace amino acids in proteins of interest. Now, we wrote this paper up, and we sent it into the journal Cell. And the editor sent it back, and he said, and rejected it. He said, it's a technological development of no general interest. And so my last thought for the young people in the audience is that if you do a piece of work you think is wonderful, and you send it into Nature or Science or Cell, and the editor rejects it, then you're probably on the right step for a successful career. Thank you very much.